Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that shape, challenge, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. It's 411 Teen, where conversation matters and insight connects. The Gen Z Lens becomes a regular feature of 411 Teen. The team brings together a dynamic blend of voices, perspectives, and ideologies. These students think out of the box, critically examining and discussing a wide range of topics. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and joining me via the Zoom platform, I welcome the Gen Z Lens student producers and panelists for 2026 academic year. May I ask the student producers to introduce yourselves and your panelists? I'll start with Simon.
Hi, I'm Simon Juice. I'm in ninth grade at McClay, and I like to play classical guitar.
Okay. Arnav?
Hi, I'm Arnav. I'm a freshman at McClay, and I like to do robotics.
Okay. Everett?
Hello, my name is Everett. I'm a sophomore at McClay, and I enjoy video production, journalism, and volunteering in my local community.
Edward?
Hi, I'm Edward. I'm a freshman at McClay, and I like to code.
And Colgan.
Hi, I'm Colgan. I'm a sophomore at McClay, and I enjoy coding and journalism.
Well, welcome all of you to 411 Teen. Today's edition of Gen Z Lens examines two seemingly different, deeply connected uses of federal power. Domestic policy. We're looking at the freezing and conditionally withholding of child care funding and social safety net programs justified by fraud investigation and administrative compliance. Foreign policy. The seizure and prosecution of Venezuelan president and his wife on narco-terrorism charges, alongside rhetoric suggesting U.S. control over Venezuelan oil and governance. Narco-terrorism is the use of violence and intimidation by drug traffickers to influence government policies, destabilize societies, and disrupt anti-drug efforts, effectively blending drug trafficking with political terrorism to achieve criminal and sometimes political aims. Let's start with the Trump administration. It announced it would freeze Child Care Development Funds, CCDF, payments to all 50 states, citing fraud uncovered at several Minnesota daycare centers, many operated by Somali immigrants. California, Colorado, New York are some of the states that now must submit additional verification and administration data before receiving funds. Simultaneously, the Department of Labor has investigated state unemployment insurance programs and threatened to withhold SNAP, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, food assistance for Democratic-controlled states unless detailed recipient data is provided. Now, critics argue that this is political grandstanding and targeted enforcement, placing an already strained child care system at the risk of collapse. Who is harmed first when child care funding is delayed and frozen? That's my first question, and I start with either Everett or Arnav, only because you're the producers and you are a little bit familiar with the first process.
I think that freezing all the child care might not be the best idea, but I do agree that there should definitely be more verification in place, because I think a lot of people have seen that one YouTube documentary where that one YouTuber went around to a lot of daycares and saw that many of them just had no children. They weren't accepting children, yet they received millions in funding. So more verification should definitely be required. But for the daycares that actually do have kids in them and are losing the essential funding that helps them stay afloat, it might be a little bit hard for them. And I'm not sure if there's really a way that, you know, you can have like verification, like, you know, you have both, like you have it both sides, because on one side, you really do need to have verification. Like, it's very important, as you can see. But on the other side, it's important that, you know, the childcare system, you know, stays afloat. Okay. So,
all right. Other comments, Simon? What? How do you feel about this?
I feel like that. Sure, there are some daycares who don't actually have children, but are getting funds, and that's not okay, and there should be verifications. But I think that this is only a couple or a small percentage of daycares across the country, and these funds are detrimental to these daycares' like existence. They really need these funds, and so I think that instead of threatening to withhold all funds from like all health daycares just because a couple of these daycares don't exist is not logical. And I think it could also be confused with political blackmailing or grandstanding, like you said. And I think it's a very sensitive topic, and I think threatening to withhold funds from everything when there's just a couple of daycares who are not legitimate is not feasible.
Let me hear from some of the panelists. Where do you all sit on this? What do you think?
I think that low-income parents who rely on these federal programs to pay for their childcare will take the biggest hit. It would be hard for them to pay for childcare. Costs are up 4.7% since last year, but I also agree that fraud should be stopped. However, Trump is withholding these costs for five Democrat-run states, which seems unfair to me when Republican-led Mississippi has a case where funds for social services were misused. So if the federal government would like to stop fraud, they should do it evenly and not just for Democrat-run states.
Okay. Any other comments on this?
I feel like for these parents who are struggling to keep their kids getting watched and stuff because they have to do their jobs or something to get money, like these people, they might not have enough, like they can't afford to pay for all this childcare that they're sending their children to. So when Trump, the Trump administration is freezing all those funds for some daycares, it will be very hard for all the parents to like pay for that. And
Okay. Other comments?
I will say that I do believe that, like Everett said, fraud does need to be stopped. But the issue I see with the overarching idea of cutting funds from all programs is that most of the investigations have only been done in Minneapolis, and where that one YouTuber went to a couple of those Somali-run daycares. And I believe that you should, instead of targeting like every daycare, you should instead target the ones that you know are committing fraud. And maybe you can expand that out to one of the other panelists said, into Mississippi, where those social security funds are being misused.
Okay. Anyone else? I think you all have touched on this. I was going to say, you know, fraud. What we're doing, we're saying fraud occurs in one state, and then how are we going to justify penalizing all the states for what one does? Kind of painting it with a broad brush. But how might race and immigration status shape which fraud cases receive national attention? I remind you that fraud called the Somalis garbage people. Those are the people from those S-hole countries. And that's a dehumanizing of a group of people. You know, so one does it, they're all victims to this racial discrimination and this racial dehumanizing. How do you think that? What do you think? How do we sit there? How might race and immigration shape which fraud cases receive national attention?
I think that race has an exponential factor in how much national attention these fraud cases receive, because as many big organizations want to do, they want everything that they're doing public mm-hmm. if it's against a race that has in the past been prejudiced and it still is. So if you, especially for those Somali-run daycares, if you are putting on a big TV that it is the Somalis that are the only people who are doing this, that's going to get you a lot of attention, and it's going to further the prejudice that will happen on those small groups of people.
I agree with Colgan and what he said about race and immigration having immigration status having a huge effect on how these cases are perceived by others, because I think that these are only a couple Somalis in the whole, there's a lot of Somali immigrants in the US mm-hmm. and they're not all committing fraud. It's just a very, very small percentage of them. And it's unfair to say because some of them are doing it, all of them are bad. And I think if you compare with the percentage of American born people who are also committing fraud, compared to the percentage of Somali immigrants in the US who are committing fraud, they're going to be similar numbers. And it's not going to be a very big distance between those two numbers.
I think you both have raised some good issues, and we will continue to look at them. It's that time I said we were going to have two breaks, so it's about time for us to take a break. But when we come back, we will continue to look at this. There are a couple other questions I want to pose to you before we go into the next topic. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I am talking with the Gen Z Lens team. Before we went on break, we were talking about just the impact of race and immigration status and how it may be received as far as national attention is concerned. My question to you is, do you think that this same approach would be likely taken if fraud were found in wealthy, predominantly white suburbs? Whoever wants to go first. Simon?
Oh, yes. So I think that it probably has happened in white suburbs, but those cases don't get national attention because I think that it's more egregious to others in America when someone non-American commits fraud than it is when Americans commit the same type of fraud. And I think that if it was in a white suburb, that it wouldn't get much attention for this matter because people won't be as appalled to it.
Mm-hmm. Other comments, other positions?
I agree with...
Go right ahead. No,
I do agree. Sorry. I do agree with Simon on the fact that it won't really get much, you know, national attention. And the main reason for that is because it's specifically the way that Americans might perceive like immigrants committing crimes, especially like the very far right ones. And especially when it's put on blast to, the entire nation, it really sets like a bad image for all immigrants of a certain race, which isn't good, especially if only a small percentage are committing these sorts of crimes.
Okay.
I feel, sorry.
No.
I feel that the Trump administration is trying to highlight something that the immigrant community did wrong, in order to justify their deportations and their immigrant foreign policy, as something like if these immigrants did something wrong, then they deserve to leave, as like sort of like a justification thing. I don't know.
Okay.
Moreover, adding on to what Edward said, I don't think it's necessarily the deportations, but more not giving illegal immigrants due process rights that they are entitled to in the Constitution, and deporting them without giving them a date in court, a chance to have due process. And also, there aren't many legal ways anymore to come to the country, especially with the new administration pouring funds from programs that were accepting and reviewing cases for people who wanted to come to the US legally into ICE, which deports immigrants and sometimes, most times, doesn't give them the due process rights that they are entitled to by the Constitution.
Why do you think Minnesota and Somali-run centers have become the focal point?
The main reason, in my opinion, is because the majority of the Somali American population lives in Minnesota. So a lot of the attention, especially with these new fraud cases, is being directed in Minnesota because that's where most of them ha are happening, because the immigrants that are committing it mostly live there.
Okay. Other comments? You think that?
I think it's also because Minnesota has a lot of left-wing constituents and representatives and who don't support the current administration. And yes, they do have a couple of, and I think they also have the most present cases of immigrants committing fraud, even if other states have people committing fraud like the immigrants do, but just not them being immigrants, the people who commit fraud.
And for you all's information, you have been correct. There are about 260,000 Somali immigrants in the United States, and 84,000 of them live reside in the Minneapolis area. So, that kind of supports the numbers, and I know you had been mentioning that, and I just pulled that up for you. What is the message that's conveyed in these actions? Simon,
Which actions,
Arna?
may I clarify?
Well, the actions that the focus is on Minnesota and the Somali population.
Well, as some of my co-panelists mentioned before, because it's immigrants committing a lot of these crimes, the way that it's being put onto national TV, it's bringing a lot of the attention to Minnesota. And so, along with what Simon said, how there's a lot of left-wing representatives that don't support this administration, all kind of come together and direct a lot of, how do I say this? A lot of not hate, but a lot of pressure on Minnesota in a way. And especially with the way that the administration actually brought ICE to Minnesota.
Yeah.
So
I'm sure you all are aware of the recent shooting. We can't help but address that in Minneapolis of the 37-year-old woman, right?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a heavier presence of ICE in Minnesota than around the rest of the country. And that's why, because of this bigger, larger concentration of ICE agents, there are more problems that are happening, like the unjust and really unlawful killing of this lady who was just killed in Minnesota. And I think that's also a reason that the fraud cases have been highlighted so much, because it's kind of like an attempt to try to mask what ICE is doing in Minnesota and like give them a reason to, like saying, oh, they're like these immigrants who are doing really bad things in Minnesota, so that's why we have to send so many ICE agents that do really bad stuff, like the killing that just took place.
And the information that is conveyed, according to news reports, is not accurate in that, you know, it sounds as if the majority of the Somali immigrants that live there are engaged in fraud. And the last report I heard was that maybe out of that 84,000, you might be talking about 5 or 6%. What does that say?
Yeah, that's a very, very small percentage. And when compared to other like categories or other races, like American and mm-hmm. other immigrant nationalities and ethnicities, that percentage is going to be very similar. And it's not like the Somali population, that percentage is much, much higher than any other. It's just being perceived that way, I think.
Yeah. Any other comments on this? Because I know you wanted to talk about what was happening with Maduro, and we can stay stuck on a topic. So before we move on, other comments, other thoughts about what's happening? I mean, what happens to public trust when social safety nets are used as political leverage? Do you see what is happening as being political leverage at all, being used that way? As far as Minnesota and the woman being killed by ICE and the alleged fraud that is occurring with child care centers?
Yeah, I think it is in some way being used as political leverage, and it's trying to, this attention on these fraud cases, it's trying to make it like, so like, they're trying to justify what ICE is doing in Minnesota and encourage more ICE agents to go to big cities because supposedly there are big problems with immigrants committing crimes.
You know, it makes you wonder, because you're getting, at least I'm getting, different kinds of information from the city mayor and the governors of these. For example, they went to Chicago, and the Chicago mayor and Illinois governor were all saying that, sure, yeah, we have our problems, but when you look at the rates, they have dropped. Why are you coming here? And it's the same type of thing in Somalia with the Somali, immigrants. And in Minnesota, the governor and the mayor is saying, we don't need you here. They've raised some questions about just the training of the ICE agents. One of the problems they say is that ICE agents don't know how to handle this. Okay. They come in and the first thing they do is shoot and ask questions later. And maybe if they had better training and knowing how to address and handle various issues that the results might be different. I don't know. What are your thoughts there? I've heard that a lot. I heard that in Los Angeles. We heard that in Portland, Oregon. We don't need the feds coming in here, because it seems like when the feds are introduced into the community, that's when there seems to be problems.
I think that crime rates and they get worse when ICE immigrants come to big cities that have been doing better on these like crime rates you were talking about. And because people, the constituents of those places aren't happy with the large presence of ICE agents. And I think they feel threatened and scared to get out of their houses. And that is causing situations to become way worse. And I think that the cities are better off without these large amounts of ICE agents going to them.
Okay. Other comments? What do you think before we move on?
I think ICE is too aggressive, and whenever they come to these communities, there always seems to be like violence. So the shooting, maybe yesterday, I don't know, today, I don't know.
It was yesterday, you were right.
Yeah. They're like, shoot first, think later. I think that should be wrong. I think that should be like ridiculed, and that's a terrible like motto and think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Talking about like the National Guard being deployed to numerous cities by the Trump administration, when the National Guard was deployed to Washington, D.C., violent crime was decreased about 30%, homicides decreased about 50%. But however, deploying a National Guard is not very sustainable, and crime going down because of it would be more of a short-term trend and not a long-term trend that would ultimately benefit D.C. and other areas.
Any other comments? All right. Yes, go ahead.
I do agree that, like, you know, illegal immigrants shouldn't be in the country, you know? If it's illegal, then obviously that's not right. But the way that like ICE shows force isn't good either. The way that they don't give any due process, that's not good. So I don't agree with illegal immigration per se, but with the way that, especially with the National Guard being deployed to many cities, especially when the National Guard is only meant for emergencies and there isn't a direct emergency being presented to any one of these cities, not a single one. So it feels like it's not required. That's what I think. It's not required. If they had targeted immigration, like if it wasn't just standing outside of Home Depots and places like that looking for people, I understand it. But the way that they just, you know, they just go into random public places and just find whoever they can, I don't go for that. That's wrong.
Okay. Well, the Trump administration announced the seizure and prosecution of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife on narco-terrorism charges in the U.S. courts. Both pleaded not guilty. Trump publicly stated he would run the country, including the oil industry, while later claiming he had no plans. He threatened Venezuelan vice president, warning consequences for non-cooperation. He has also floated ideas involving Greenland and Cuba and other territories, raising questions about territorial ambition and resource control. Many analysts argue the move is less about narcotics enforcement and more about geopolitical dominance, particularly oil. When we say let me say, but put it this way. Why might the U.S. choose criminal prosecution over diplomacy?
I think that, first of all, I think that Maduro was a dictator and a very bad man, and the Venezuelan people did want a different leader. I just don't think that it is right, and it sets a precedent, a dangerous precedent, to invade a country and take their leader out, and it destabilized, like, Venezuela was a pretty stable country before this, but now they're very unstable. The citizens don't know what's going to happen next, because Trump is claiming that he's going to run the country, but now the vice president, who is also bad, is running the country. And I think things are very uncertain, and it is not a way he should have used to go into a different country and without consulting Congress.
Okay.
I believe that Nicolas Maduro was an illegitimate leader, as did the USA and 50 other countries. And I am, from what I've seen the Venezuelan people be both happy and, you know, disappointed with what happened. But I do think that ending that authoritarian regime in Venezuela will be positive in the future, hopefully, if we're able to figure out what to do with the country, as in with its leaders, because I think that it should be a democracy. And
hold
I did
thoughts.
See recently.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I want to ask my panelists to continue his thoughts. We had to interrupt you.
I recently saw on a tweet that Donald Trump announced that 30 to 50 million barrels of oil were being put in American hands to be sold. And I just wanted to state my opinion on that, all the money going there is going to be put into an account, which is going to go straight to Venezuela to improve the morale of the country, the infrastructure, everything that needs to be improved on that. And I do believe that that is a good idea.
Okay. Other comments? Yes.
Sorry. I wanted to respond to Colgan for a second. I think that I agree with you that it was an illegitimate government in Venezuela, but there were other ways to pressure that government to go off, and even like capturing Maduro and then putting in a government that the Venezuelan people choose. So like someone like Machado, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, or Rodriguez, who was imprisoned by Maduro because he wanted to run against him. And instead of, because right now it is still an authoritarianism government with the vice president, because she was put into place by Maduro. And I think that first of all, the strike could have been executed better. He should have consulted Congress, and instead of setting the precedent that he can do whatever he wants without consulting Congress. And then after put in a Venezuelan government that, instead of completely taking control of the country.
Okay.
I first want to start off with the fact that Maduro not being in control of Venezuela is a massive humanitarian win. And I feel like there's really no way around saying that. Even the people who don't approve of this, I feel like can at least agree on that. That's the first thing I just want to state. The next thing I just want to state is that is that I don't think that the country should just be kind of left alone without a leader. Because I know some people are criticizing the fact that the US is running the country. I don't think that it should be left alone without a leader. And while the US is making decisions on its behalf as to pumping oil, on one hand, this could benefit the US. We don't really know for sure what's going to happen. On the other hand, I feel like it's still a good thing because at least if they don't set another leader and help the power be transitioned, there's a very good chance that something like this will happen again with another dictator and they'll end up just back in the same spot. Now, for the point to where they kidnapped essentially the president, I think that he wasn't the thing is that he wasn't a legitimate illegitimate re leader. But at the same time, it does not set the right precedent for other countries. It is it's technically, it's technically like a crime. And so in that, while it's already happened, I have to say that it was a good thing, but I don't think that this is something that they should have done. Since it already happened, there's probably going to be benefits coming out of this, but I don't think it should have happened in the first place.
Okay. I mean, what message does seizing a foreign leader send internationally? That's something else to look at. And I just throw that out there for you all to respond to.
So I think that it shares the message, and I think it is the message that this administration wanted to send out and has sent out, that if our president wants to do something, he can do it, and he's not going to consult Congress, because he didn't consult Congress until after this happened, after the first strike and Maduro was captured. And he was not, it destroys the purpose of checks and balances, and then it threatens other countries that he has personally threatened before and after this happened, such as Cuba and Greenland, as you said. Like Greenland, for example, which is controlled by Denmark, and I think the Greenland citizens are happy about that and don't want America to take over. And but Trump is still threatening to do that, and there's nothing that can really stop him unless except for other countries. But it doesn't send out a good message about what happened.
I will say that I believe that if Donald Trump had consulted Congress, that this mission could have been leaked and potentially destroyed by anyone who was not willing to let this happen. This did happen before when a president didn't consult someone, when Obama did not consult Congress on killing Osama bin Laden. But I do think that there could have been better steps to take.
I agree with Colgan. The executive branch routinely takes military action in the absence of a full scale of authorization by Congress, which is what happened here. But I think we can all agree that Maduro was a bad president, illegitimate president. After only 8 years of him ruling over the country, GDP dropped 75%, and he authorized tens of thousands of extra judicial killings.
I agree, but I think that there could have been a better way to do this, such as if the America captured Maduro like they did and brought him back, and then instated a government. A leader, a Venezuelan leader that has the best interests of Venezuela in mind, and that Venezuelan citizens will enjoy and want as in power, just like Machado, like I gave an example of before. And then secondly, not using this opportunity as a opportunity to boast about America's power and threaten other countries who do not have authoritative governments, who have good governments. And there's like no reason for us to go to Greenland and capture Greenland. There's no logical reason. And I think that which might have been a good thing, capturing Maduro and taking out an authoritative government, but using that to threaten other countries who do not have an authoritative government, that's not okay.
I agree with Simon. I think maybe the best course of action would be to create a fair election that the Venezuelan people can vote for a new, fairly elected president.
Yeah,
I
what
agree with Everett. That makes a lot of sense. And I hope that eventually that is the outcome that happens in Venezuela, because I know for now US is taking control, but I know that Trump said eventually they're going to try and transition power. I hope that they will have a democratic election and that all will be good for them.
I agree with this, but I feel like the USA hasn't given out a real robust plan to set up this election. They haven't sent out a timeline. They don't, and Trump is changing his stance on the oil, on leading Venezuela. He's changed his stance since the capture of Maduro, and I think it installs a lot of uncertainty. And then with the vice president who's claiming control, that creates another level of uncertainty and confusion. And I don't think there's a real timeline here to when we're gonna have a democratic election in Venezuela.
Simon, I do think that it has not been enough time to actually fully plan out something. And even if they have planned something out, which I do hope they have, because this should have been in the works for months, I don't know why they would release it, especially this early, to normal citizens who really don't have any involvement with anything that's going on.
I agree with this, but on the other side, Trump has taken a stance on issues involving Venezuela since the capture of Maduro, but he's changed his position. He has revealed things, his plan with what to do Venezuela, but not really concretely. And I think he should have not said anything about maybe saying, oh, we will run Venezuela until an election, but not change your stance saying we won't run it and then we will run it. I don't think that's good.
Something that I noticed about this administration is that they do change their stance a lot, which really has brought a lot of uncertainty, not just for this, but in a lot of the decisions that they've made. So I don't agree with that, but it's also been the same that it's been for a lot of the other decisions. On the other hand, I do agree with Colgan. They're not gonna open up an election this early. Something like that takes time to plan. And so, in this case, only time can tell. We just have to wait and see.
Yeah, but I feel like things like this have already happened, that the US captures illegitimate governments, such as in Egypt, where the Egyptian government fell. It was a dictatorship with the help of the USA, which was good. But then another dictator was put into power and he hasn't left office since 2011, I think it was.
Well,
I feel like
no, go right ahead.
the US, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I feel like the US has pushed a ball down a hill. So they have control of the ball for a while, but then it's gonna go all over the place and where you're not gonna expect where it's gonna go. So in Venezuela, there's not much stability with the capture of their president. So it's gonna end up with like a power vacuum where multiple it might go into civil war with multiple like factions trying to vie for power. And that, yeah, we just don't know yet because it's the beginning. We just have to wait and see.
I agree with that, and I think what makes this situation even more out of control is the fact that Trump, after all of this has happened, said threatened other countries, multiple other countries, such as Greenland, that he's going to do the same with them.
Which leads me to my question of what are the risks of the U.S. acting like a global prosecutor? Because that's another perspective. I mean, you know, we are sitting here and we're going to prosecute this one and that one. And what are the risks?
My stance on that is the thing is that for Venezuela, I feel like this won't really apply to them because of the fact that the country is at least it's pretty happy about what happened with its president. They didn't like the president. Their economy was tanking. I think they're pretty happy. Now, if we're talking about other countries and if the U.S. was to do this again, there's always, especially if, you know, if it was a leader that the people liked, but the U.S. didn't like, if it was something like that, there's a major chance of rebellion and, you know, possibly starting a war. And that's, you know, never good. But the reason why I personally haven't really, you know, worried too much about this, at least for this specific case, is because of the fact that the citizens of Venezuela seem pretty satisfied with what happened.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree, but I think that the way that the America is not superior to other countries. No country is superior to all the other countries in the world. And I feel like Trump, with taking the stance on threatening to remove leaders and take control of countries that he feels like he should have, is not okay. And I think that it's up to those countries if they want something like that to happen. And clearly they don't. Like, Greenland has taken a firm stance on not wanting to, for not wanting the USA to come and invade them. And a lot of countries have backed them, including a lot of countries in Europe that are allies with the USA.
Mm-hmm. My question is, why are some authoritarian leaders prosecuted while others are tolerated?
I think that the biggest problem in this case is that there's been a lot of reports about strikes on specifically Venezuelan ships, and it's more, at least from what's been publicly reported, it's more coming from Venezuela than any other country. And taking down Nicolas Maduro from power is going to stop at least a majority of those from happening.
Well, I think that that ships that are smuggling illegal goods aren't just in the Caribbean, aren't just coming from Venezuela, and not even the majority from Venezuela, because I'm sure in other oceans and there are a lot of smugglers doing that. And I think it's instead of, I don't know, yeah.
I feel like U.S. is only prosecuting Venezuela is because of their oil. So I feel like this is like the second Iraq. So when the U.S. came into Iraq and, quote, liberated them, they were all happy. And then the Americans left, and it fell into a power vacuum. And now everything is terrible in Iraq. And I feel like Venezuela is going to be the same thing. We're going to go in, release the oil, and, like, for all the companies and the United States to use and to buy, leave Venezuela for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And I saw something, I think it's Citgo or another American based oil company is set to, under Trump's plan of taking the oil from Venezuela, is set to profit billions of dollars. And be, instead of Venezuela profiting from their oil, that American-owned oil industries, oil companies will profit more than them.
Well, you know, and this, we're almost out of time. Both of today's discussion topics have involved claims of wrongdoing, and they've wrongdoing as far as the use to that are used to justify the exercise of power. A key question, and we can't answer this, is when governments act in the name of accountability, who decides where accountability ends and coercion begins? And it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Many thanks to the Gen Z student producers and panelists. Today's conversation illustrates the insight of youth in making sense of complex and challenging worlds. To my listening audience, much appreciation for the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.